What I'm talking about is once you basically, with this two-pronged approach, reduce both the fiscal impulse and the liquidity impulse into the real world, like we did in 2022, with a year of lag, generally speaking, in 2023, you're going to see the effects ripple through the real economy. You're right. Going to see most likely a recession, most likely a serious weakening of the labor market, which means banks aren't going to feel comfortable with lending money to the private sector because it's weakening from a creditworthiness perspective.
This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Goldrock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice. This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, and my name is Darren Rockman. I am a partner at Goldrock Capital, the 22-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth families in Israel and around the world. And very pleased to welcome onto the podcast today Alfonso Picciano, and I think I got that name right, more or less, even though my Italian is pretty awful. I'm a big fan of Alfonso's. He is, amongst other things, the co-host together with Andreas Larsen of the Macro Trading Port podcast, which is actually one of my favorite podcasts and something that I would recommend to all of you. Welcome, Alfonso, to Definitely Uncertain.
Hey, Darren, such a pleasure to be here. And thanks for the kind words about the podcast and my work.
Yeah, no, it's really terrific. It was launched, I think, earlier this year, and it's been a huge success for Alfonso and what to listen. He's also the author of The Macro Compass, which is a financial providing actionable investment ideas. And prior to doing this, he was in a big bank. He was at ING Germany, where he was head of investment portfolio for the Treasury Department, and he was in charge of $20 billion in the multi-asset portfolio. So Alfonso's got real practical experience and, as you're about to find out, real macro insight as well. So Alfonso, let's get started. Markets rallied early on in November on the back of a really great piece of news, which was an inflation of 7.7%. Isn't that worth celebrating? Let's go back a little. Where are we on the inflation story?
Darren, where are we is, I guess, at an inflection point that will accelerate into a disinflationary trend, but only late in 2023. So we are at a point where we can say that we have seen the peak in year-on-year inflation. We all hope so. Otherwise, where do we go? 10, 12% inflation? Nobody wants that. From now onwards, it's the pace of the decline that matters the most for the Federal Reserve. And where do we land, actually? What's the new landing point of inflation in this new regime? Taking a step back for a second, how did we get here? It's by a massive amount of real economy money, spendable money being thrown at the customers, the private sector, the clients, the households, the corporates, people who can spend money on goods and services. In the U.S., through $5 trillion, which is like 20% plus of GDP, of really like real money, bank deposits that people could spend. And then the economy reopened, and then there were supply bottlenecks, and then all of that combined.
This all happened around COVID, yeah.
That's correct. So I'm describing the second half of 2020 until the first half of 2021. The last fiscal stimulus in the US was in March 2021. And basically, until summer 2021, when this ripple effect of all these fiscal stimulus and reopenings and the supply bottlenecks were all happening at once, we basically saw this demand pushing up very rapidly, and the supply couldn't adjust as rapidly, also because of the zero COVID policy in China. So when you have a lot of money being thrown at the same amount of goods and services, then the price needs to go up there. And that's what happened, and we saw happening across the board in Europe, in the UK, in the US, everywhere, until, say, half of this year. That's been basically a lagged effect, which always happens with inflation. It's one of the most lagging indicators in the economy. And we saw that. But now, when we look into 2023, we basically, because inflation is a lagging indicator, it will react to what happened in 2022. And what happened from a fiscal and monetary perspective in 2022 is the exact opposite of what happened in 2021. We are tightening the belt. We are not doing QE. We are doing QT. We are doing quantitative tightening, not quantitative easing. And on the fiscal stance, we aren't throwing any new money, any new fresh fiscal stimulus to the economy. Actually, we are trying to withdraw some resources from the economy.
Right.
And the Federal Reserve has tightened policy on top of that.
So I want to take a step even further back. Okay, what happened in 2020 was a repeat of what happened after the 2008 Great Financial Crisis, which was we were at the brink. Central banks said, hey, here come the helicopters. We're going to flood the world with money, make sure that there's plenty of liquidity around so that the banking sector doesn't get destroyed. And I think at the time it was $3 or $4 trillion that they pumped into the economy. And from 2008 through to 2022, despite that, we had no noticeable inflation. And I think that was a story that central bankers talked themselves into, that, hey, we can do this without consequence. Why was it different this time? Why has it been different in the 2020 example to what happened in 2008?
So the difference was that the money created in 2008, 2009 was money for the financial sector. So we repaired the bank's balance sheet. We made them more liquid. We did a lot of quantitative easing. And quantitative easing basically takes bonds away from the private sector and gives them reserves. And reserves are liquidity for banks. So banks became more liquid. Their balance sheet was repaired. But the real economy didn't actually get much money. If you look at the fiscal stimulus in the US or in Europe between 2008 and 2010 to fight the great financial crisis, was minuscule compared. So the US, I think in 2009, threw at the real economy something like $700 billion, and this time we did $5 trillion. So that is the real difference. And not only we did that in the US, but we did that in Europe. UK did that. Japan did that. Australia did that. Everybody opened up their fiscal stance because they needed to fight an exogenous shock, which was the pandemic. The world was closed. So giving money to banks wasn't nearly enough this time there. You needed to give money to banks, to the financial system, basically, which we did with quantitative easing this time as well. Mm-hmm. But the real difference in 2020 was the fiscal stimulus. The concerted amount of fiscal largesse that was there to make sure that us, the real economy actors, the one that can drive inflation there and the one that can drive spending, corporates, households, we got a bunch of money, spendable real economy money, on top of the financial money that was thrown through quantitative easing. And this combination is actually very inflationary.
Okay. So you mentioned before quantitative tightening, which is the opposite of quantitative easing. Quantitative easing is you're adding money into the system. Quantitative tightening is you're pulling it out. There are two things happening at the moment in parallel. The main story is in order to fight off this inflation, central banks around the world, led by the Fed, are putting up interest rates and have done so relatively quickly. They went from a sort of lackadaisical, it's all going to be okay, as we would say in Australia, don't worries, mate, to, oh my God, we have to be worried, and here we go, and we're bringing out the big guns, right? But at the same time, they're doing this quantitative tightening. How is that going to impact the sort of story going forward into next year?
So the transition between quantitative easing to quantitative tightening is a pretty important one, because now banks are not seeing new reserves, new fresh blood being thrown at them, new liquidity, they are seeing less of that. So their balance sheet becomes less liquid, which means that their appetite to take risks, to oil the financial system with liquidity, to throw balance sheet at the financial system, actually goes down. That appetite moves down. And so you are seeing that already being reflected in the illiquidity of the treasury market. People and listeners must have read some headlines that the treasury market is becoming more illiquid. And that's indeed correct, because when a bank has less liquidity, less reserves, less oil, basically, in their engine, they become more conservative. They do not throw money at the financial system, at markets. They rather are more conservative. And so that is happening there. And at the same time, and this will keep happening, by the way, in 2023, the Federal Reserve will keep shrinking their balance sheet by almost $100 billion a month. It's a very large amount. So that will happen at the same time when also the government is saying, sorry, guys, no fiscal stimulus anymore for the foreseeable future. And with the midterms there that basically hampered Biden's administration power to unilaterally go ahead with fiscal stimulus going forward, I think 2023 and 2024 are likely to be periods where both the fiscal stance becomes tighter and the monetary stance becomes tighter at the same time. This isn't good for assets in general.
And really that quantitative tightening means that banks have to call in loans or not renew loans so that they generate additional liquidity, which actually takes, as you say, takes fuel away from the financial system.
So Darren, the way you look at it, if you're a bank, you're trying to lend money to the system. If you see an economy which is growing and creditworthy borrowers, people you lend money to at good rates, maybe today, like today, you know, you can make loans today in the US at 6-7%. That's a decent yield on a loan. The problem there is that your balance sheet is becoming more illiquid as time goes by, and the creditworthiness of the private sector, I think, will be highly challenged in 2023. What I'm talking about is, once you basically, with this two-pronged approach, reduce both the fiscal impulse and the liquidity impulse into the real world, like we did in 2022, with a year of lag, generally speaking, in 2023, you're going to see the effects ripple through the real economy. You're right. Going to see most likely a recession, most likely a serious weakening of the labor market, which means banks aren't going to feel comfortable with lending money to the private sector because it's weakening from a creditworthiness perspective.
What's the risk of overshoot? We had a big overshoot on the way up. Clearly, with the benefit of hindsight, which is 2020, you can see that too much money was pumped into the system. It wasn't necessary now creating all types of unintended consequences. What's the chance that we have the same problem on the way out, that this combination of quantitative tightening and lack of fiscal stimulus, drawing of money from the system on both sides, is going to lead to a deeper recession than really is necessary?
Very high. The chance is very high. And let me actually move to two jurisdictions outside the US to make an example. So people are telling me, Alf, they have tightened up the belts and nothing really bad has happened so far around the world. And I invite people to think about what's happening in China, where the biggest asset class in the entire world, which is the Chinese real estate market, it's bigger than the US stock market, it's bigger than the US bond market by a mile. It's deleveraging at an extremely rapid pace. So a lot of damage is being done to the largest asset class in the world already. So that's happening. And if you look at a place like Europe, for example, to answer your question there, when a system that is highly leveraged and it's complex as a system gets shaken up under its foundations, to be honest, the soft landing is the last thing you can expect because this system tends to react in a non-linear way. So let me explain what I mean with Europe. Europe is a place that for 20 years has enjoyed a very good business model based on two sources of leverage. The first was cheap energy coming in from Russia mostly. So think of Germany with only 30 billion imports of natural gas. They could produce 2 trillion of manufacturing value added. So the leverage embedded into this cheap energy flow and in this offshoring of supply chain, everything was on time, everything was cheap. That was the first leverage. And the second was financial leverage. I mean, big companies in Europe could borrow at 2% there. That's just ridiculous. Yeah. And now these business models, you can just balloon them up, leverage them up, and everything looks great because leveraging is so cheap. A mortgage was 1% for 30 years in Germany before the pandemic. House prices look cheap to anybody if you can borrow for nothing there.
Sure.
So now these two sources of leverage, we are unwinding both of them. Cheap energy, forget about it. Available energy, forget about it. In-time supply chains, forget about it. Cheap rates, cheap borrowing rates. Even the European Central Bank is now forced to raise interest rates. We're talking about 3% risk-free rates in Europe. You need to sum up credit spreads. Italy doesn't borrow at 3%. They need to borrow at 5%.
Sure.
So you're challenging very complex systems on both sources of leverage, economic and financial leverage. And how can you expect a linear, smooth, soft landing? That's not my base case.
Okay, let's now put a little card to that. What does a hard landing look like? Or what's the difference between a soft landing and a hard landing?
So a soft landing is the dream of the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank. It encompasses...
It's coming up the ski jump and you're sliding down the thing and you're getting applause at the bottom.
Yes, that would basically mean that unemployment rate moves up from the lows 3.5% to maybe 4.5% or so, still a pretty tight labor market, some job losses, not many. And then GDP comes down a bit, but inflation drops like a stone back to 2% in 12 to 15 months. That's the dream from a Federal Reserve perspective. Here's instead what my macro models are telling me, Darren. My macro models are telling me that yes, in 2024, cyclically speaking, we are going to see inflation back at 2%. We are going to make it. But we are not going to make that with unemployment rate at 4.5%. We're going to make that with unemployment rate at 7% in 2024. Massive job losses. We're going to make that with a recession of a few percentage points of GDP being taken off from growth. We are going to make that with a housing market that takes a serious dip because affordability is off the charts. It's impossible to afford a house anymore. And people are going to be losing their jobs on top of that. So some forced sales are going to come to the market. So yes, we're going to get there with inflation down at 2%, but it's going to be a recession that brings us down there. So it's not going to be all the happy and the soft landing story. It doesn't just fit.
So at moments like this, there is always the risk of unintended consequences. We saw this a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, in the UK with the pension system and the Bank of England having to bring in the fire truck, if you will. Just goes to show that all the talk about central bankers not having any ammunition left was premature. They still have got plenty. Are there any major sources of concern that you have that could break, as with the housing market being a great one? We had that in 2008. What are you going to be watching?
So I think the two places that I'm watching right now are the housing market and the car market, the car industry. So the housing market is pretty straightforward to explain. If you look at sales in the US, housing sales, they are down 40 to 50% year on year. Basically, the housing market is frozen there. And it's easy to understand. New buyers can't nearly afford the new marginal buyers at these prices with a combination of high mortgage rates and high house prices. Forget about it. They can't buy it.
Yep.
Sellers are trying to hold off from selling. And they're saying, I'm not going to hit the lower bid. I'm just going to wait. So basically it freezes, right?
Yes.
Now, the problem is that when it freezes, after 6 months, all these construction workers, brokers, flipping businesses, all of those are going to get out of business, or at least a decent portion are. So the job market is going to weaken. And then sooner, in my opinion, sellers will need to be forced to sell. And then the house prices start to drop because there is a forced seller. The buyer is not as strong. So the only way to find a new equilibrium is at lower prices.
Sure.
I expect house prices to drop 15 to 20% in 2023 across the board. So that's a serious thing to watch at because it's such a leveraged system. Banks are exposed to the housing market. And when banks start to weaken their balance sheet and get hit on their balance sheet, you need to be careful with contagion effects. So that's one. And the second is the car industry that also basically benefited from this hype in 2021 as supply bottlenecks were really hard and car parts couldn't get done. Basically, you couldn't get a new car delivered to you. It took 2 years if you tried to get a new
car. Secondhand cars were worth more than people had paid for it. And people were lining up at airports fighting over rentals.
And Darren, many banks and many leveraged businesses were set to finance this used car business because it seemed like used cars could all go up in price.
Sure.
And as you said, used cars seem to be more expensive than new cars. So people basically rode this wave. And now used car prices are getting a big hit because the supply bottlenecks problems are getting resolved. Demand is not as strong. Supply is slowly picking up. And now what about all these financing businesses or all these car financing businesses? And again, banks are exposed to a certain extent to those as well. So I'm watching banks and I'm watching the housing market and the car market as well.
So given all of that, positioning for investor, because that's a pretty gloomy scenario. You could run to cash, but it's a hard thing to do when inflation is running as it is. So how are you thinking about asset allocation for investors?
So I think if you have an horizon of 6 to 12 months and you're a medium-term investor, let's say you're looking into 2023, you need to think that risk-free rates are in the US at almost 5%. So you can basically buy short-term T-bills or bonds yielding 4 to 5%. In an environment where real growth is coming down fast and inflation, especially in the second half of the year, as a result, will be coming down as well. I think finally, after a year and a half of beatings, the bond market looks like a decent place to have at least an allocation. Start considering again that you're looking at a risk-free return, which is in the 4.5-5% area, which is pretty palatable during the recession, I would say, as a hurdle to have. When it comes to the equity market, a lot of people are telling me, hey, Alf, but the Fed is going to pivot because the labor market will weaken and growth will weaken and inflation will weaken ultimately. So the Fed has to pivot. And I do agree at some point later on, they will pivot very late, but they will pivot because things are not looking good. That's because they will pivot. So this is 2001 again, where, yes, the Federal Reserve cut rates by 475 basis points in a year. That's a true pivot. Rates were cut from 6.5% to 1.5% in 15 months, Darren. That's a pivot. But the equity market didn't rally. Why? Because earnings were taking a beating, because people understood that we were in a recession in 2001. You don't buy stocks when you are in the middle of a recession. You buy stocks when the recession is actually plateauing and the central bank is a commodity, which is something I expect in 2024, early 2024, not in 2023. So also careful with these Fed pivot stories that are going to lead people to try and chase rallies. In July, we had a new bull market. In November, we had another bull market.
Big 5% day.
Those are bear market rallies there, and they are hard to navigate because they make you rethink. They make you wonder whether you, if you're underallocated, you're doing the right thing. We're going to see some of those again in 2023. The Nasdaq rallied 7 times, over 20% between 2000 and 2001. 7 times, 20% rally, but it only bottomed in mid of 2002. So that's the kind of we're looking at now.
Okay. And investment grade bonds?
So investment grade bonds are an interesting place to be because they benefit from this high risk-free rate that we discussed, and on top of it, some credit spreads that have widened. But you're looking at decent rated companies. You're looking at companies with a good balance sheet. So I like to have some of that in my portfolio. I'm just now looking at how to assess the asset allocation into 2023. And these investment grade bonds, I have to say, they should be part of the book to a certain extent because they deliver a nice carry that is not purely risk-free, but the amount of risk in it compared to the return you're looking at, I think it's a decent combination to have in a portfolio for some allocation.
Right. I want to go back to the beginning of the conversation. One of the things that various people, Elliot put out a note about this last week, they're concerned about is we've built up this massive Fed balance sheet. I think it's $9 trillion, if I haven't got that right. Even at $100 billion a month, that's going to take a hell of a long time to unwind. And you would think that if your prediction is correct, and this time next year, the world's going to be at 7% unemployment, it's going to be very hard for the Fed to continue with their quantitative tightening. Where do we end up? A balance sheet of $8.25 trillion. How do we ever get rid of this? And what does it mean for the global economy?
That we don't get rid of this. It's very simple. So we make every time an attempt to unwind monetary and fiscal easing, and notice that every time the attempt is shallower and shallower. So in 2018, we tried to shrink the Fed balance sheet between 2018 and 2019. The market said, sorry, what? I don't like that. And back then, Powell could easily pivot in January 2019 because inflation was very low. So it was a relatively easy pivot. But the Fed kept shrinking slowly the balance sheet in 2019 as well. And the repo market blew up in September 2019. That's another symptom that the world, the financial system can't handle a lower balance sheet. Same right now, we're going to try again. We start from a very high point, so we can actually, I think, remove some reserves from the system without causing immediate damage. But sooner or later down the road, there is going to be, again, a reason for the Federal Reserve to stop, a systemic reason, something big, like the treasury market isn't functioning, the repo market isn't functioning. Something will pop up.
Areas of the financial system that most people don't care about, understand, or want to know.
Shadow banking, the repo market, the euro dollar market, all these very complex pieces of the puzzle, they depend on liquidity, they depend on leverage. And simply when you close the tap, at some point, something is going to pop up. The Federal Reserve this time will be more prone to continue their tightening simply because inflation is way, way too high. They are trying to regain some credibility after getting it wrong for 2 years, basically, Darren. So if you are Powell now, you're just going to keep at it, as he keeps saying. Keeping at it, by the way, is the name of Paul Volcker's book.
Yes, of course.
Keeping at it. So he tries to emulate his hero, whatever he's trying to do here, and he will keep at it. And this increases the risk of a systemic blow up somewhere, ultimately over the very long term. Darren, our growth is the function of population growth and productivity growth. And on a demographics perspective, look at the next 20 years. Oh my God, the Chinese workforce will shrink by 20 to 30%. Every workforce in Europe, in Israel, in the US, wherever you look at, population will be aging and the fertility rates are not enough to offset that. So the number of workers will shrink. Productivity, yes, it keeps increasing a little bit year by year, but it doesn't offset that shrinkage of demographics that much, which leaves you with very poor structural growth rates. How do you offset those? You inject liquidity, you lever up, you create debt, you then send basically new liquidity to the system. And every time you try to prop up this growth and returns until you're forced to slow down. And when you slow down, you create damage to a very leveraged system. And this will go on over and over again.
Okay. All right. And then one last question, which I'm going to sum up in one word. Crypto
is such a difficult topic there. And I remember when I presented myself saying, guys, crypto is an asset class. The digital asset space is an asset class. It's not a cult. It's not something that you shouldn't treat it as a religion. You should treat it as an asset class. So as an asset class, it has pros and cons and characteristics there. And so as an asset class, it has the following characteristics. It's a high beta asset class. It does well when animal spirits are running high. It does well when financial liquidity is very high and the economy is growing. It's basically Nasdaq on steroids, if you wish. And then there are obviously some long-term potential technology use cases that you might want to attach to the asset class, which actually make it an asset class to consider in a portfolio. But to consider in a portfolio is different than to get
all of your pension in FTX.
I'm sorry, but my job is to rationalize the macro landscape and asset classes for investors and make them understand that there are macro cycles. And crypto is not immune from micro cycles. Actually, it reacts very viciously to those, both on the way up and on the way down. And this is a macro cycle that does not support a strong allocation to crypto. There will be times again where you can overweight the asset class, but not today.
That's fantastic. Alfonso, I really appreciate you being on the podcast. It was just a pleasure.
It's my pleasure, actually. And I hope that your client base finds this interesting. If they want to reach out to me, can I actually say how can they do that, Aaron?
Sure, go for it.
Sure. I think the easiest actually is to send me an email if you guys want to reach out. themacrocompass@gmail.com is my email address. I also do bespoke consultancies with different kind of investors, family offices, ultra high net worth, and so on and so forth. And I have different products in case people want to reach out. Happy to help.
Great, fantastic. Alfonso, thank you very much. And to all of you out there, thanks for listening. And look out for more podcasts coming soon your way. Be well, bye-bye.